Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now for the first week of June. I'm your host, Nan Evans. Today, we will listen to the second part of an interview I did with wildlife biologist Jim Bodkin about sea otters. But first, let's hear this week's mystery sound. The idea to actually use this bird as the mystery sound came to me during a walk this past week. I could not immediately identify it, so I stopped to listen and watch. I'll share its identity with you a little later in the program. First, Nature Now's multi-talented sound engineer Charlie Fleischman will help me share a few observations from around our town.
Everybody with a hummingbird feeder these past few weeks has been treated to entertaining explosions of hummingbirds, mainly rufous fledglings, around their feeders. Chris Jones up on Morgan Hill calls them a crowd of feisty aerial acrobats. The rufous hummingbird makes one of the longest migratory journeys of any bird in the world, as measured by body size. During their long migrations, rufous hummingbirds make a clockwise circuit of western North America each year. They move up the Pacific coast in late winter and spring, reaching Washington and British Columbia by May. As early as July, they may start south again, traveling down the chain of the Rocky Mountains.
This past week, I got an email from Wendy Feltham, one of our most observant local naturalists. Wendy wrote me that she had seen one of the most remarkable and beautiful marine creatures she had ever seen. It was a daisy brittle star. Wendy found this curious little animal while exploring the rocky intertidal out at Salt Creek, west of Port Angeles. The daisy brittle star, just an inch or so across, has a bright orange central disc covered with fine blunt spines and oval plates. It uses its five textured pink and gray striped arms to scurry along the bottom, to cling to rocks and pebbles in strong currents, and to gather up bits of food. Wendy included a photo she took of this amazing little creature, and I certainly encourage listeners to go online to check out the critter. The scientific name of the daisy brittle star describes it, in Latin, of course, as serpent-like and armored with horny scales and spines.
Out near Cala Point, the Admiralty Audubon sightings webpage reports that Renee Marth and Bill Voss spotted two red crossbills at a tube seed feeder. A crossbill's odd bill shape helps it get into tightly closed cones. The bird's biting muscles are stronger than the muscles used to open the bill, so the red crossbill places the tips of its slightly open bill under a cone scale and bites down. The cross tips of the bill push the scale up, exposing the seed inside.
On Nature Now during the first week of May, I interviewed Jim Bodkin about the biology of sea otters. You can listen to part one by going to the podcasts on KPTZ's website and searching for sea otters. Jim recently retired to Port Townsend after a long and impressive career with the federal government as a research wildlife biologist in Alaska with the U.S. Geological Survey. Jim's focus was on population biology and the ecology of marine mammals, especially sea otters. Today, we're talking with Jim Bodkin again, and we're going to talk about the challenges faced by sea otters as a result of human interactions and the lessons that this interaction and these events provide about sea otter biology and their recovery and conservation. So thinking historically for a moment, the fur trade comes to mind, but as sort of historical or maybe prehistorical context for that, did the indigenous native people hunt and use sea otters, and what did they use them for?
Yes, the answer is they certainly did use sea otters. We find evidence in archaeological middens throughout the North Pacific of the presence of sea otters, and oftentimes in quantities that suggest that they were actively pursued and collected. We also know that, at least in the northern part of the Pacific, in the Aleutians in particular, that the Aleut people developed a very sophisticated method to hunt sea otters, a communal method that required a fairly large number of individuals and individual kayaks. And in fact, that method was really the hunting technique that allowed for the fur harvest to begin.
So they were using the fur or food?
Yeah, they were probably using the fur. It's most likely that they were using the fur for warmth, and because of that, they were probably more used in the northern latitudes as opposed to in the southern latitudes.
Although I certainly would guess that any animal they hunted, they would use all of it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the furs were traded as well. We know that they were traded so that there's evidence of sea otters away from the coast, so that they were a commodity that was traded with other peoples.
So when we think about the historical fur trade, we think essentially about what the Russians, I guess, basically started. And they started in the Kurils or the Japanese islands, northern Japanese islands. And that would have been the early, mid-18th century. Is that about right?
Right, about 1750 or so.
Okay, so the after Vitus Bering and
right. All
that stuff. I think most of us probably know that lasted through to the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, when, at which point, the sea otters were nearly extinct. So fill in the details. Tell us about the harvest. Why was it so lucrative? And when did the Americans kind of get into this game?
The furs were highly prized, again, because of the density and the luxuriousness of these furs. And most of the furs were going to Asia. There was a huge market, and they were extremely valuable. There were fortunes made early and throughout the period of harvest. In fact, these pelts were so valuable that towards the end of the fur trade, when otters were extremely rare, they actually would have vessels that would be out for months at a time and come back with just a few pelts.
That made enough money to support a month-at-a-time trip?
Right, right.
Wow.
Even though by the end of the fur trade, they became so rare that it became economically unfeasible to continue to pursue this commodity.
And you mentioned when we were chatting before we turned the recording on, that the early Russians actually enslaved some of the Aleuts?
Yeah, they did. Kind of a dark part of the story of the fur trade. But as the fur trade began, the Russian hunters basically enslaved the Aleuts, who had developed this ability to hunt sea otters essentially with spears, because this was before kind of modern firearms became available. So I doubt if we would have had this fur trade had it not been
for the
Aleuts, who had learned how to hunt sea otters.
And then the question about, okay, this is the Russians. They sort of enslaved the Aleuts. They've used their technique. When did this get to the North America, and when did the U.S. get involved in the fur trade?
It's kind of a complicated story, because the Russians were kind of dominant and kind of managed the fur trade exclusively for about the first nearly 100 years.
Was Ivan Doig's Sea Runner story, was about a Russian camp. Was that a sea otter?
Right, right. It included sea otters as part of that story, right?
So that was just sort of a brain flash.
The Russians were actually trying to regulate the harvest, because by the mid 19th century, they had seen the decline and the unsustainability of the harvest that was ongoing, and so they implemented some management that included harvesting only males to try to secure the long-term harvest here. But that was about the same time that it became an international harvest, and by this time we were in North America and we were working down the coast of North America. Once this international fleet came in, kind of all bets were off in terms of management, and it became more of a free-for-all, and rapidly led to kind of the near extinction and the removal of sea otters from, you know, over 99% of their habitat. And they're reduced.
And that's the entire rim of the North Pacific, essentially.
Right. And it reduced their numbers from probably close to 300 or 400,000 animals before the harvest, probably to a few hundred animals scattered through 13 different populations, mostly in the northern parts of their range, but with one population in California.
Thinking for a minute about the efforts for a sustainable harvest and that not working, and yet I understand that it didn't take, in terms of annually, a huge percentage of the population, but why wasn't it sustainable?
Well, it had to do with the way the harvest was allocated spatially. As we talked about previously, you know, these animals have a very small home range.
Mm-hmm. You said just a few kilometers.
A few square kilometers. On an annual basis. And the harvest was concentrated. So even though only, you know, maybe 1 or 2% of the population was harvested every year, that harvest took place in a very small area. And then they would kind of move on to the next area and deplete that area. So if they had taken that 1% of the population annually, had it been distributed more broadly throughout the range, we probably never would have seen a decline in sea otters.
So I'm sort of envisioning this kind of progressive deplenishing of the sea otter population as they worked around.
Very much a kind of a serial depletion.
That's a good way to think about it.
And that's where kind of the individual biology, the life history of the of the organism that you're harvesting comes into play. And you have to understand that in order to sustainably manage a population.
Back to the home range issue. It's very small, relatively quite small.
Right.
Yeah. Most of us, I think, know that the sea otter population has rebounded in the 20th century. What happened?
A number of things happened. Probably first and foremost is during the course of the harvest, we took a lot of animals, but we didn't degrade their habitat. We didn't affect the habitat in the process. And so once we stopped harvesting them, there was good, suitable habitat. In fact, there was excellent habitat because in the absence of sea otters, their prey respond by increasing in size and abundance. And so after decades of absence of sea otters in the system, prey population is plentiful and it's abundant, and it facilitates rapid recovery of the sea otter population. So habitat was good. We stopped harvesting sea otters in 1911 under the protections of the International Fur Seal Treaty. And then later in the 20th century, we actually started conducting translocations or relocations of sea otters from Alaska, where there, some of their populations persisted, to places like British Columbia, Washington, and Oregon, and Southeast Alaska as well. And so today, somewhere about 20% of the sea otter's abundance, which is now at about 125,000, about 20,000 of those animals are the direct result of those translocations that took place in the beginning of the 1960s.
If I'm remembering the numbers correctly, it's the current population is not quite half of the sort of population at the beginning of the Russian fur trade, essentially.
Right.
And I know some of those translocations have been really successful and some have not. I know the effort off the coast of Oregon was not.
Right.
Any thoughts about why we have success somewhere and failure other places?
Well, the Oregon translocation was one of the earlier translocations, and we didn't know a great deal about husbandry and about the need for these animals to maintain the integrity of that fur. They're very susceptible to kind of contamination or degradation of the quality of their fur. So their fur basically has to be able to retain an air layer, because it's that air layer in the fur that actually provides
warm,
the insulation. Yeah. So that was one of the reasons for kind of some of the low success rates of the early translocations. Also, these animals have a strong affinity for their home range, for where they live.
Of course. They live there a long time, and it's a small home range.
And they know
course,
it very well. When we pick them up and we take them to a new habitat, even though the habitat to our eyes is excellent, has lots of food for them and no competition with other—
It's not home.
It's not home. And so we moved 142 animals out to San Nicolas Island in the 1980s, and within a year— 90% of those animals had gone.
Wow.
And we know that they swam back the 100 or more miles back to where we caught them. And they went back to their home range.
Yeah.
So that's another reason for the kind of the limited success of almost all the translocations. Mm-hmm. We see a large decline following the translocation. And then kind of a slow recovery until they actually start attaining this exponential growth rate that we've seen in almost all of the successful. And then they can grow quite rapidly.
It was interesting to me when you were talking about the fur trade that there really was no impact on the habitat. The next thing I want to ask you about, which is the Exxon Valdez oil spill that many of us remember. It was spring of 1989.
Right.
Prince William Sound, when the Exxon Valdez oil tanker went aground. spilled massive amounts of crude oil. Many marine conservationists probably would consider it one of the greatest catastrophes. I remember the sea otter being almost the poster child of that oil spill, that catastrophe. And I know you were quite involved with the research following it. Tell us about the short-term impact of that spill on the sea otters.
Again, because of the reliance on the sea otter, on the integrity of its fur, and the effects that oil in particular has on matting that fur and basically
removing its insulation.
Right. We also saw a great deal of inhalation injury.
Oh, that huge nasal cavity, in fact, they're feeding and...
Right, and they're and essentially they're breathing hydrocarbons. And so we saw pulmonary emphysema was a very common kind of symptom of animals that were dying or had died and had, and others that had been brought into the rehabilitation facility. So because of that direct contamination of the fur and as well as inhalation of hydrocarbons, we don't know exactly how many animals died acutely, but it was probably at least 1,000 and potentially up to several thousand animals died from kind of acute effects of direct exposure to oil.
What were scientists assuming in those early years? Did they assume that the short-term impacts would pass and the sea otters and other critters would sort of come through it?
Begin the recovery process, right. It was assumed that acute effects would be the strongest effects and that those would diminish rapidly because the oil dissipates fairly quickly in the environment. But it turns out that wasn't necessarily the case for all species. It varied according to a species' individual biology. So in the case of sea otters, if we took out, let's say, 1,000 animals out of western Prince William Sound, which is probably close to what it was, the thinking was that, well, there was still lots of sea otters in Prince William Sound. They would simply move over to this now vacant habitat. Well, as we subsequently learned, these animals have a very small home range and a high fidelity to that home range, and they just didn't do that. The animals that survived in that area, they formed the nucleus, and they were the ones that would be responsible for the recovery. But what we also learned was that a fraction of this oil ended up being sequestered in intertidal shallow water sediments, the same kind of habitats that sea otters feed in. They're really great excavators. When they're digging for clams, they can spend a lot of time and they can remove a lot of sediments.
Yeah, and they can move rocks around and get under things.
And in the process, we found that they are becoming kind of continually exposed at a much lower level, of course, but that was, again, hampering recovery of sea otters. And so it was over 25 years before we actually saw kind of recovery to levels of sea otters in the most heavily oiled areas, at least, of western Prince William Sound. It took 25 years before the numbers approached what they were at the time of the spill. We probably were conservative, but we still know that there's still oil out there and that there's still animals that are likely becoming exposed to that oil. But the rate is diminishing over time, the volume of oil. In a large sense, sea otters were responsible for recovery of that habitat and that lingering oil that is in there through this process of excavating sediments, releasing that oil. But again, they paid the price in terms of kind of a prolonged recovery period, as did some other species.
Yeah. There's sort of some obvious takeaway messages from this, but what's your basic sort of biological or ecological takeaway message from the Exxon Valdez spill experience?
Well, first and foremost is that to understand the effects of our behavior, the human behavior on systems and species, we really have to have some information about what populations and communities, biological, ecological communities look like before the impacts that we impose have.
So unlike the fur trade, where it was mostly an individual biology, this is an ecology question.
Right. Well, in order to understand what the effects of these types of events are, and I don't want to limit it just to oil spills because there's lots of kind of catastrophes that will happen. In order for us to understand what the effects are, we need to know what populations and what the ecosystems and the communities look like beforehand. And so that's an important lesson. And the other one was that we really didn't have the understanding of the natural history of the animal to fully understand what the long-term effects might be. And for some species, there's still not recovery. Mm-hmm. And we may not see recovery because of their individual kind of behaviors and life histories that just won't allow them necessarily to recover.
Jim, I want to thank you so much for sharing your expertise here on Nature Now. This has been fascinating.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, that was a really interesting discussion, and it makes me want to know more. But we are running out of time today, and we still need to identify that mystery sound and talk about upcoming events. That was the buzzy song of the spotted towhee. The spotted towhee is a large sparrow. It's almost as big as a robin. Has a striking black head and back, wings that are spotted with white, and a white belly, and what I like best about these birds, a warm rufous-colored flanks. Spotted towhees rummage in the leaf litter. Towhees tend to hop wherever they go, moving deliberately and giving themselves plenty of time to spot food items. They scratch at leaves with a characteristic two-footed backward hop, then pounce on anything they've uncovered. The birds can be hard to see in leaf litter, so your best chance for an unobstructed look at this handsome bird may be in the spring, when the males climb into shrub tops to sing their buzzy songs. So let's now look at what is coming up in the next week. Charlie, what's on the calendar?
Starting June 3rd, the marine exhibit at the Port Townsend Marine Science Center will be open for its summer hours, Wednesdays through Mondays, from 11 a.m. until 5 p.m.
And join the Native Plant Society on Friday, June 3rd, for a walk to Cranberry Lake. It's a rarely visited bog, or sometimes called a fin, near the headwaters of the Dungeness River. Expect to see typical bog species such as the bog laurel, Labrador tea, sundews, and the bog bean. Check out the Native Plant Society webpage for details.
On Saturday, June 11, the Native Plant Society is also hosting a walk in Old Fort Townsend State Park to explore old growth and parasitic plants. The walk will travel multiple trails in the park to highlight the unusual plants growing in the old growth environment. Several parasitic and mycorrhizal-dependent vascular plant species will be seen and their parasitic life cycle explained.
The Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society is sponsoring a field trip to Lost Mountain on Tuesday, June 7th. Expect to see and hear the amazing array of birds that breed on the North Olympic Peninsula, including sapsuckers, McGilvery's warblers, olive-sided and Pacific slope flycatchers, purple finches, and much more. Check the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society webpage for details.
For another bird outing, join the Admiralty Audubon Society on Saturday, June 11th, for a day of forest birding in Fort Worden.
So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas, or even if you think you might be interested in joining our team of Nature Now hosts. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. That's naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ on Thursdays at 5 p.m. and Saturdays at 11:30 a.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is The Sea, performed by Moe.